it's time. We are back for lap six of the Sideways podcast. We've got with me my co-host Scotty Taylor, as always, and we also brought on multi-time singles tuner champion, mild mechanic Andrew Butler. How are you doing today?
What's going on?
Doing pretty good, man. This is exciting. Andrew, thanks for taking time to chat with us. I think this will be a fun little talk since you guys have some chemistry from the past, winning championships, and you've been pretty busy these past couple off seasons.
Yeah, no problem.
Andrew, so for the fans that don't know, what does your normal day look like? Obviously, a lot of the people in this sport can't be full-time mechanics. There's just not enough funding for that. And realistically, we all have to be able to pay the bills for our families. So what is your day-to-day like?
Well, I have a normal day job, desk job. I do CAD drawings, fabrication drawings for structural steel.
Not have expected that. How did that passion arise? What led you into that path for the day job?
In high school, that was like the only class I was good at was the CAD class. And I actually got pretty lucky with it. Sam Lowe, Trent and Jared Lowe's dad, he's a co-owner in a steel company here in Cincinnati. And when he found out that, you know, I was doing CAD, he was like, hey, you know, we got a job for you, because they have what they call steel detailers that take, you know, the design drawings from the architects and make them make sense for the shop to make and for the iron workers to install.
We, Andrew and I, back in 17, we put Andrew's skills to the test at the end of the season, and he designed the like first heavy wheel that was used in the singles class. And I don't know how long, I don't know if people used them before that, but it definitely been like the first mag wheel that had been around for a while. And Andrew's the one who designed that bad boy. And then eventually we're able to get the championship of that thing.
How do you balance doing all this for full-time work with also trying to make time to stay in touch with the AFT series and working on the bikes that you have to compete for championships?
So like I said, I'm pretty lucky because, you know, having Sam Lowe as essentially a boss, you know, he's always going racing too. So it's kind of hard for them to get too mad at me. So I kind of, you know, follow the same schedule. But I'm pretty lucky with it. They kind of let me have a lot of freedom with it. So I'm definitely blessed as far as that goes. So, and on that Lowry wheel thing that you brought up, all I did, like, I just kind of drew like the idea, the shape of it, the general shape of it. Jeff Lowry, Jeffrey's dad, he had made one in the past for, I believe, the Lloyd brothers, for like their Ducati. I don't know how, you know, long before that was, but he had done one, and I had seen a picture of it somewhere, Facebook or something. And then, you know, when Colby and I were, you know, talking about it and joking about it, and Tim kind of gave us the green light on it, Tim Essenson, I was like, you know, I'll get a hold of him. And I kind of drew a little sketch of what I thought would look cool. And he's, you know, Jeff Lowry was like, yeah, I can machine that. I don't know if it'll work. I don't know, you know, engineering wise. And we were kind of like, yeah, whatever, let's just give it a shot. It's not going to break. So it was crude. It was definitely a lot different than like the current heavy wheel setup. But yeah, we had a little part in it.
Yeah. And then we brought that thing into the hotel room the night before the Texas half mile. And we were trying to be real secretive about it because nobody had really used one yet. So we had that thing in the hotel room with some mother's polish and like this pad, and we were trying to polish this thing up the night before the race. And we mounted it up for the first time in the parking lot of Texas, and we took it over to make sure it met weight. And yeah, it was kind of neat to break that thing out. And kind of ever since then, you know, mag wheels are just so popular now in the singles class.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was different. You know, it wasn't like the quick change wheel. Now It had, you know, like carriers for stock sprockets and, you know, for the brake rotor as well. So we had to have like multiple carriers so that we could have, you know, a couple sprockets ready to go. And it was definitely different. It was more like a framer rear wheel, you know, where you take each side off to flip it. But yeah, it was pretty cool, and it met weight, and, you know, Dale Jens gave us a look, and it was like, yeah, you guys are good to go. So that was the start of it.
No, it was cool because like earlier that year, I didn't know that heavy wheels would be good. My tech savviness wasn't there. So like the heavy wheels thing. And then earlier the year, I'd heard people were using liners in their tire, and I had no idea what that was. So then it was trying to figure out a legal way, because having a liner is obviously legal. So it was us trying to figure out how a legal way to have as much weight. So at one point we had this like Michelin tube that weighed, it was way thicker. I don't know what the weight was, but it was way thicker than the normal tube. So that was the closest thing. And then we just gone ahead, and I can't remember who came up with the idea, but we went ahead, like Andrew said, we got the green light, and we went ahead to Lowry and had him, you know, make this wheel for us. And then, yeah, it was pretty neat. It was just cool to look back on. Me and Andrew joked about it maybe a year ago or so, and like just talking about how much it's came from then to now, everyone just using them.
Yeah, it's pretty wild when you look at the class, and like 90% of them almost have them on their bikes now. And back then when we started using it, like nobody had it. It wasn't even a thought. I mean, nobody had mag wheels at all on 450s. So, I mean, except for Weirback, you know, years before, you know, with some old style PMs, but
that's right.
Yeah, we kind of started a trend. It was kind of cool.
Colby, what did you notice as a rider from making that change when you guys started going with that heavier wheel?
Just better grip, you know, just like everyone kind of uses now. It helps settle the bike down a little bit, and a lot of times it can help get better grip, especially like the next week at Paris. We had that thing on, and we had a brand new 2018 Yamaha that we just got, and it just gotten released. It was bone stock. It made like 53 horsepower slow. But we put that thing on there, and it locked down around Paris half mile. We weren't fast, and the wheel probably didn't help the top speed, but it was fully locked onto the groove. It was good.
Andrew, with your time with Colby, obviously working with the Yamahas until you know, moving over to the KTM team in the past few years, from a mechanical standpoint, what were some of the differences you noticed about working on those Yamahas versus when you moved over to KTM?
So, you know, at the time with Colby and those Yamahas back then, the 2014 up to 2018 models, like the issue with them was they had like a hinge or a pivot in them. Like they wanted to get sideways so bad, you know, and do a 360 in the middle of the corner. And so, you know, like that was why we implemented the heavy wheel, was to try to help the thing roll in and not be so reactive in the center and want to come around to try to roll it through that. So, you know, we fought that a lot, that and traction with it. And, you know, there was a little bit of time in between the Yamaha thing with Colby and then the KTM things. And I was, you know, a couple Hondas and things in between, but, you know, all of them are kind of similar. The KTM though, I mean, by far is my favorite. I don't think that you can beat the handling of the steel frame, of the Austrian brands.
We did a race together in New York, and it was kind of when I was starting to work with the Essenson deal, and we hired, well, I guess we didn't hire at that time, but I mentioned that I wanted to start working with Andrew. And so we had him and his dad come out to New York, and I was still on my Hondas at that time. And we got third place there, which was cool. And then we finally got our hands on the Yamahas because they just weren't ready for New York, and they really probably shouldn't have been ready for Calistoga. But we went out to Calistoga, and normally like on the forks, you can see on the lower leg, you'll probably see like 7.5, 8 inches of chrome on the 450s now. When they're lowered down for flat track, these things probably had what, Andrew, maybe 6 inches. Like we showed up to Calistoga completely unprepared. The bike, I'd ridden it for like four laps at JD's house, and it was not running right. And then so we get to Calistoga, and I think there's maybe 18 people signed up that day or 19. And I think we go out first session and we're like 17th. And we kind of are just looking at each other like, what did we just sign up for? But we turned it around that day. But man, those forks were funky. We had them so far down in the clamps to try to make it work.
Yeah, that thing was, I mean, we weren't sure what we were getting into. You know, with the bikes, they were new to us, but had been raced previously, and we didn't know anything about them as far as how they were set up, who, you know, what weight and all that. And I think they were done by Penske, I believe. Mm-hmm. So it was like, you know, a little bit more old school, like low and slow kind of setup. And, you know, Colby's riding style doesn't quite fit that. And just for what we were trying to get out of the bike, the forks were way too short. I mean, I think like by the end of it, you know, of our time together, we had the forks probably like 2 inches longer than what we started. So, yeah, definitely a lot changed from beginning to end there.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a journey, that's for sure. I think too, right before Calistoga, we were down in Cyprus at Factory Yamaha, and we were getting the bikes tuned up, and I'd put the spring broke, I think, and I put a spring puller right through the part of my hand between my thumb and my pointer finger, and it was a pretty big hole, and I'm not super queasy or anything, but I almost passed out right there looking at this thing. And that day too, it was, the bikes were dynoing fast. Like on paper, they were really slow horsepower wise. But then when we finally got on them at Calistoga, I was making passes around the outside on the straightaway. I remember they were quick. They ran good. That's for sure.
With all the, like, I mean, we have like various surfaces that we race on and various like track sizes and everything. So just me being dumb when it comes to setups, what do you guys try to look for in terms of like your gearing and your tire pressures when it comes to short tracks versus half miles, cushion versus clay?
Oh man, that's kind of a hard question because every rider is so different. And I know that's a generic answer, but it is true. And then, you know, like when you get asked that point blank, it's a hard to answer because like, I feel like we go off of notes, but you also kind of go off of like your memory. You know, we walk up to the track and look at it and go, oh, this place kind of reminds me of, you know, Bridgeport, or this place reminds me of, so you kind of debate and discuss what track it reminds you of and kind of go, you know, go with that. And, you know, some people and some teams, they'll have different softwares and they'll measure out the track and put, you know, what gear ratio. And like, I know KTM kind of had something like that where they would guess, you know, ahead of time what gearing we would need by measuring out the track and inputting it into their computer, and it would give them the gear ratio that we would need. And it was pretty dang close, to be honest, but I'd say most of the time we just kind of look at it and, this place looks like, you know, this place looks like Lima, or this place looks like old Savannah, and just kind of toss on what we think will be right to start.
Yeah. And then, like he said, it's so dependent on the rider. With G&G, I could hop on the bike that Corey rode with his exact setup that he could go out and win a race on, and I would be terrible. And then he could hop on my setup that I could do well on, and he would be terrible. It's just, some riders like their stuff stiff and fast, or stiff and slower, and just each rider's so individual with their setup and how fast they can go on it. So it is like a blanket statement. Like he said, it's like, oh, that's so rider dependent, but it's as true as can be.
And it's it varies so much too. Like, it's not as simple as like tall guy versus short guy. I mean, you know, you can have a tall guy that's aggressive, or a tall guy that's more of like a finesse rider, or a short guy that, you know, is either or. So it really is about the type of rider and what they like. And then also the track too. I mean, you know, how banked is it, and what is the surface? Is it, you know, a pretty hooked up surface or loose, or, you know, anywhere in between. So.
And then another question. So this actually is a question that my dad had for you. He was curious about, you know, do you get to adjust the length of the intake track to modify airflow? And if, you know, it used to be done with the carbureted bikes, but he wasn't sure if it was important with fuel injection. And I have no idea what he's talking about. So,
yeah, definitely. That's something that, can be done. And, you know, it all depends on your package. It all depends on, who built the engine and, who tuned it. And, you know, like with KTM, we had a couple different length, essentially velocity stacks that fit into the air boot, like the stock airbox. You know, and some guys have that same thing. Some guys have, you know, throttle bodies that have velocity stacks, you know, essentially epoxied to them. And so you're kind of stuck with whatever one you come up with there. But they can be different lengths and diameters as well. But, you know, honestly, in my opinion, that's not as important. And I'm only saying that because, you know, I've had the success I've had with in the last 4 years with the KTM guys without ever changing any of that. You know, we never needed to. We kind of took one engine package and took it everywhere and did well with it. So, I think in some cases that can be important, but I think that it's, you can do more with the rider and their choices, their lines, you know, their strategy, or racecraft, as one would say, and Corey, and then your setup, obviously, bike setup. So, you know, and then you can do a lot with the fuel tuning with the ECU, your ignition timing and stuff. So, I think, you know, actually doing intake length, that's more something that, you know, you do on the flow bench, or you do testing on the dyno to see what gives you the, you know, the best or most optimal power curve, torque curve that you want to see. And then you kind of roll with it from there. The Twins guys, they might use that more. I'm not totally sure. The little bit that I've messed with some Twins on the dyno, it's made a difference. But I probably, you're in the same boat as, like I said, with the 450 guys, that really you get what's the best for you in your opinion, and then you kind of just run with it.
We were just, Andrew and I were just talking about a couple weeks ago about like what we think would be best. I've got this wild hair that I want to build a bike for Springfield Mile for someone to race. So I was just running some ideas off of him. And intake was one thing we were talking about there.
Andrew, with all the success that you've had in the singles program, and you talked about, you know, messing a little bit with Twins, do you have aspirations to end up, you know, tuning on Twins and try to chase a championship with a rider in that class?
Well, you know, the game plan, you know, going to 25 was to do that with Cody. And obviously what's happened, you know, with the state of the sport and the opportunities that were there or not there for him. So, you know, I'm definitely open to going to it, but it's really, you know, with the right rider, right ride. You know, I have such a good relationship with Cody that, you know, I don't have any second thoughts about trying to go to the Twins class. I'm not as knowledgeable there, but I feel like with him and with his dad, you know, I could learn pretty quickly with those guys. But as far as the future goes, like, I'm not against it, but I really like the 450 class. It's what I've had success with. It's what I enjoy working on. And I've spent a lot of time, you know, trying to learn or perfect them. So it's just kind of, you know, it's what the opportunity's been. And so I've just been rolling with it.
You talk about that relationship with Cody. You guys have obviously found so much success. I'm curious, like, these past two off seasons with the transition that came with, you know, Red Bull KTM pulling out and you guys having to put that program together. How was that experience for you? What was that offseason like? And to piggyback off of that, this year with Cody, then, you know, finding that opportunity with Moto America and the new plans that you have going forward, how did that come together as well?
So yeah, for this year, the 24 season, it was a bombshell. I mean, really, it was all, you know, going with the flow as far as we're going to go into the next season, you know, from 23 to 24 with Red Bull, and we were all still going to be on the team, you know, same riders, same mechanics, and everything was fine. And then all of a sudden, you know, we all of us got the phone call like on the same day, you know, within hours of each other, that they were shutting it down and that we all lost our jobs. So it was just like an instant, you know, a flip of the switch. You're everything's fine and you're on the team and you don't have anything to worry about, to nothing at all. So it was a lot of unknowns. Joe and Cody immediately went to work, you know, trying to put something together. And it was constantly progressing all the way up until Daytona. And I fully mean that in, like, he didn't have the Rick Ware deal until like the week before Daytona, you know, finalized. So, you know, we were the latest, you know, racing KTM's, you know, full-on title sponsor up until right before when Rick Ware came on, and it was a combination deal. So that was a whirlwind. And, you know, fortunately for me, I didn't have to do too much. You know, I was just at, you know, here in Ohio doing my day job and just texting and calling Cody all the time. And we were always talking about different things and, you know, what we were going to do and different sponsorship ideas of who we could go for and just kind of fun stuff like that. But, you know, for Joe and those guys, it was probably a nightmare trying to get it together. But really fortunate that KTM tried to do right by Cody and essentially sold him or however it went down the program that they had. So the bikes we ran this year were the Red Bull bikes from the previous season, everything but their engines. So the full chassis, the wheels, the suspension, everything was the bikes from the previous year, but just not the engine. They put in, you know, stock engines for us. So it was like we had the whole package except for the engine. So it was relatively simple, you know, in that aspect. So then Joe just had to go to work finding who he was the most confident in having do the engines. And it ended up being Wally Brown, and it worked out really well. We had a great bike for, you know, the whole year.
Yeah, you guys came out of the gate swinging, winning Daytona. How rewarding was that for you?
I mean, for all of us, it was like a sigh of relief. And it was kind of, you know, like, I think one of the first things that one of us said was, you know, we don't need no factory, you know, right after he crossed the finish line, because, you know, it was a lot of work and a lot of anxiety, you know, for the Gopp family to go racing, you know, on their own after going fully supported for the last couple of years. So it was definitely an unknown, like, well, what's going to happen here? Are we going to be lost? Or, and luckily it went really awesome. I mean, we had all of our notes from the previous years and essentially the same bikes. So, and obviously same rider, same guy, he didn't change. So yeah, it was really awesome to get that first win.
How crazy is it now, like, going into next year, all of us thinking about Cody Kopp's not going to be on the field, he's going to be on a road racetrack? I mean, there's no way any of us had it on our bingo cards. I wouldn't imagine. The bike that he's going to race, they're pretty sick. I don't know if you guys have looked them up yet. They're trick little things. But there won't be any number ones next year racing because Jared's gone too, and then Cody won't be out there in the singles class anymore. But it was very unexpected and just like kind of a shock when the news all came out that he was going over to Moto America to work with Kenny Roberts and fast track on those bikes to try to get over to Europe eventually.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the, you know, to answer the rest of Scotty's question from before about how this deal came about, you know, It is wild. It's another bombshell. We had, you know, 2 years in a row now for Cody where it's like, you know, lost your job and then, oh, there's no job available. Let's go do something different. So, you know, I don't know all of the details about how it came together for him. You know, talking to Cody on the phone, he just said he basically just made it sound like he just got a call out of the blue from the King Kenny. And he was just like, hey, you know, we want to do this talent comp deal. We want to put together a team. And, you know, it's like, I want a dirt tracker who's got a lot of talent. And he's the guy that they wanted. So, and he, you know, he called me about it and he's like, what do you think about it? And I was like, dude, I would do it. I mean, you know, it, and he knows it. And I'm sure his mom and dad told him the same thing. But I was like, dude, you know, you're young. You know, you're in your prime right now. You are not going to miss anything, you know, here in Flat Track because there's no team for you anyway. He was in the process of searching desperately to find some sort of, you know, ride for the Twins class. And I was like, dude, it's not like you're missing out on a factory Harley or Indian ride. You know, like you can come back next year if you don't like road racing or, you know, you suck at it, which I doubt, but you know, I was like, you're not missing anything, so why not, you know? And then an opportunity with Kenny Roberts, like, how can you beat it? You know, you're going to have some of the best mentors, you know, people around you for the sport, so, you know, you're set up for success.
Yeah, it summed up well. There's no reason, I mean, he's not going to miss anything. There's no rides available, and, like, when we say that, it's not that there's no bikes available, it's just there's no rides available to the point in standard of what Cody should be on. For him to go out there on a bike that's, say, like a 5 through 10 bike, it wouldn't do him justice to his career for what he's built up over the last couple of years and his talent level. He needs to be on a bike that's competitive and, you know, 5 through 1, being able to win the races and be able to go for championships again, up against, like, Dallas, Breyer, B-Rob, especially next year with so many unknowns going away from the Indian. And there's so much development that these teams have to do on the production bikes to try to catch back up to the Yamaha. It's the essence in Yamaha is so good. And these production engines are going to, the teams are going to have a big learning curve to be able to try to get to where that bike is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and where he was at before he got this call for the road racing, I mean, he was essentially putting together his own team and going to build bikes or, you know, take somebody's old bikes and try to make them better. And so that's kind of where the sport is right now. You know, I know, like, in Formula One, they call them seats, and that's where he was at. There was no seat for him to take. You know, there was no team with an available opening. And then, like Colby said, there a lot of these teams, almost 90% of them, were running Indians, and now they can't. And so they're all going to something new to them. And so it was going to be all development for most of the paddock.
Yeah, and the rules didn't restructure enough to make it like a new level playing field for all the production bikes. And on one hand, it wouldn't be fair to the Essensen team because they've, you know, gone through the trenches since 2019 trying to get a bike that's as good as the Indian. But on the other hand, it's their bike is going to be quite a bit better on some tracks, on the slippery tracks, than a lot of the other bikes just because they have so much development and that bike is so good. I mean, it was to the point where it could compete with Indians bar to bar, at least the restricted Indians bar to bar. So, yeah, I'm interested in that. Like, Breyer's got that year of development under his KTM. So I'm curious what they're able to figure out over the off season. And exactly what he's going to do next year if he's still on that deal, and just to see what level they're able to get it to try to compete with that bike.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty hopeful with the rules. I mean, I know a lot of people are upset that they didn't do enough. And then, like, the traction control, that's, like, the hot topic. I think that what they did with taking away the wheel speed sensor is going to make a pretty big difference, because you got to think that about how, like, you know, the track is ever changing, especially, you know, when you're out there for freaking 35 lap main event or whatever it is for the twins. But you know, the track as it deteriorates, the Estenson bikes with the wheel speed sensors and their technology and all the work they've put in are able to adapt as the track changes. And, you know, other guys don't have that or aren't as good with that ability. And so taking away the wheel speed sensor is going to make a difference. You know, they're not going to get better and better as the race goes on necessarily. So I do think it'll help. I think it'll be more like, you'll see a little bit more like, you know, the days of Brian Smith on the Howerton Crosley Kawasaki, where, you know, the rumors were always that he had some sort of, you know, electronics and traction control, and it would have been a little bit more like this, where he didn't have wheel speed sensors. And if he did have something like that, it was, you know, you whatever you put into that ECU and roll out for the main event, that's what you're stuck with. Whether it's too much or not enough, it is what it is. So I'm hopeful that what they've done does, you know, kind of even it out a bit. I mean, obviously they're still going to have advantage. They're still going to have, you know, some TC, and they're going to have obviously all of their, you know, notes and things they've done in the past and be able to put it in. You know, they've already got the knowledge, but you're not going to have that, the bike that's able to continuously make itself better as you're riding it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a bit bigger than some people on the internet think. I do wish that, I guess the biggest thing they could have done was just take away those external flywheel covers and go back to the stock cover, and then whatever you can do inside of that, whatever the limitations are from the production side with the stock covers, I think that would have been neat, because then it really would have shown a lot more between the different engines, like the KTM and the Yamaha, more so what the production engine is able to do with the aftermarket flywheel covers, with how big you can make them and how big of a flywheel you can get in there and the circumference. It's tough too for like the privateers. Like, I wouldn't even know where to go start. I know that Wally Brown sells that kit for the KTM, but say I wanted one for a Yamaha, I don't even know where I would start to try to find one and be able to get one in time for, say, Daytona, and how much it would cost to get that made.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tough part about that. And then I agree that, you know, kind of limiting some things like that would definitely help, because it's all about, you know, the connections you have for people that can make these custom items, and it can be tough. There's not a whole lot of shops out there that can or will do it. And then obviously price is another issue. And then, you know, how long it takes to get the part made also. So yeah, that would help too. And hopefully they do something like that, you know, for the future.
Yeah, with these new rules, I think Daytona's, I don't know if it's going to make a whole lot of difference down there. I think Daytona's going to be Daytona. It's still going to be relatively competitive and wide open. But as we go throughout the season, you know, it's definitely very much an unknown, a wait and see kind of what happens. I'm a little I'm curious how this year is going to go. It could be very, very, very hopeful if it does make the field more competitive with this, but there are some lingering concerns there. I know some people think that Dallas is going to win all 16 races, and well, I don't necessarily believe that. We'll kind of see what happens.
I'm excited. Like F1, I feel like next year F1 is going to be a really competitive series, where Verstappen's won the last four championships, but going into next year with McLaren so good and Ferrari so good, and the Honda Red Bull car doesn't seem to be improving quite as much as, say, the McLaren and the Ferrari, and then Hamilton going over the Ferrari. It's so flat track's kind of in the same sense, where there's a lot of excitement going in next year, at least for me, with so many different production engines and so many riders switching brands, where it just kind of leaves the imagination and leaves us things to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can kind of be hopeful that it goes the way Formula One has gone. I mean, it's been a few years coming. You know, you had the Red Bull team and Verstappen dominating and almost unbeatable for a while there. But as time has gone on, you know, the other teams have caught up, and it's become very, very competitive and a lot more entertaining to watch. And I think that kind of goes towards, you know, like what some guys like Corey and others I've heard talk about it, where you get a rules package that's set for, you know, 4 or 5 years, whatever it is, and that's that, and you don't touch it. And you know, obviously some teams are going to start out great, and other teams not so great, and they're going to have to work to catch up or meet that other team. And I think that we might be kind of seeing that right now, seeing that happen. And I hope that AFT can get something good together and lock it in, and, you know, people can start to try to work towards the level or the bar that Estensen has set or is going to set this coming season.
Did either of you guys watch that dirt car race in the dome last week? That's like one good thing that Flow, since we had to pay for Flow this year.
Oh yeah.
Did either of you guys watch that?
Gateway? Yeah, I watched a little bit of it, some clips. Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. They do a good job making it a show, and then obviously 30,000 people in there. The main event, I don't know if you watched that, Andrew, but it was good. It was entertaining to watch. I had a buddy come over who he just works with me. He knows nothing about racing at all, motorcycles, cars, nothing. And he was sitting there and he was kind of eating it up. He was enjoying it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of excitement there.
It's a spectacle. It's not what you normally get from late model racing. It is definitely a one-off special event for them, but it is very well marketed. It's very well shown. It's a fun event to watch, for sure. I've tuned into it the last few years they've had it, and there's definitely no short of excitement. You have guys who make a name for themselves there, either by winning or crashing, and they get, you know, one-off interview, you know, sound clips that'll go viral off of them saying something wild, or the dude that was running across the pits or running across the track to fight somebody under red. But that is quite the spectacle. A couple years ago, I was asked, like, you know, who the contact was for that and how much it cost to put that event on, and like, is there a way to get like flat track on a facility like that, or just, you know, to try to promote an event such as that? And I could never get a legitimate contact. I believe Cody Sumner is the dude who's involved with it, but I just don't have his information.
You know, I've been saying it for a while now to you know, some of my friends here and you know, in racing, and I'm excited to actually bring this up and see what your opinion is, Scotty, but like, I keep saying, man, I wish that like AFT would adopt the World of Outlaws business model, or like hire somebody that works there, you know, whatever it costs to you know, poach them. But like, if they could follow the way that World of Outlaws do things, and the way that they take their series around the country, and the types of tracks they go to. I mean, I'm always drooling when I see these tracks that they go to are just awesome. And I don't understand why we aren't going to, you know, some of these car tracks too. We keep going back to some of these ones that are not so good or run down. And then you watch World of Outlaws and they're at, you know, obviously like a Williams Grove or like a Housette's or, you know, Knoxville. Like, what? Why are we not going to some of these legendary car tracks that are just beautiful? So yeah, I wanted to bring that up.
Well, I think a lot of it probably has to do with just the relationships that World Racing Group has with these facilities. They have a really good rapport with them. And whenever the Outlaws go somewhere, like, I know one of the interviews that I listened to around the whole time of the World of Outlaws and the High Limit deal coming up. For me, like, I do production work for the Outlaws on Dirt Vision, but I'm also a subscriber to Flow, not just for Black Track. I was before that. I'm a big fan of just racing in general. But one of the things that people were worried about with that split is that when the Outlaws want to go somewhere, they want to guarantee the promoter a sellout. And so that's why they make drivers have these, you know, platinum agreements. And so that you're going to see some of the best guys guaranteed are going to show up. And that builds excitement. I think they're very good at finding different markets and spreading it around to where it's not too oversaturated.
Do you think it has something to do with like consistency? Like, do these sprint car races always go back about the same time of year to these tracks for, say, the last 5-10 years?
Yes. So for the Outlaw schedule, and some of the drivers even get burned out about that because it can be very, you know, repetitive. But you have, again, you have these relationships, you have these big events, you have these dates to where it's an appointment for the fans. They can mark it off on their calendar 300 days in advance. Hey, I'm going to need to take off the second weekend of August for Knoxville Nationals. Hey, I need to take off the, I think, third weekend of July for Kings Royal National Open right there, you know, into September, early October. Having that, you know, consistent like date on the calendar and having those relationships with those tracks, it allows people to plan and get excited about something going forward. Sprint car racing is definitely in a great spot. And a lot of these car tracks, they see the quality of racing that the series gets. They, you know, see it getting talked about a lot on, you know, social media and shown off. They see these drivers' personalities, and the product itself is excelling. And I think that's where, you know, shouts out to the drivers and the sanctioning bodies for building the sports up. I think AFT is definitely, and flat track in general, is falling short of that. Although there's definitely a groundswell of people involved in the sport who I think want to change that direction and get, you know, it more modern and get more eyeballs on it and make it more attractive to just a common fan, to where you can associate with a rider. They can, you know, relate to those guys through their personality and how they showcase themselves on and off tracks. And just a lot of these sprint car guys have a good brand. You look at David Gravel. He has a YouTube show in the off season, and he's very good about posting stuff on social media. And that goes with a lot of drivers too. Rico Abreu is super popular and does a great job with that.
Think about how much money some of those guys made last week just off of their merch sales that they had, because all the dirt car guys do such a good job with merch. And then all of the people at the race, the spectators, they love, you know, to support the racers, and they like the merch because genuinely it's a really cool product. But I think too, like with the consistency thing, Jared, he capitalizes on it really good. You know, always the last weekend in June, Lima Half Mile, Springfield's always the same weekend. Daytona Beach is always during bike week. But a lot of these other races are just kind of randomly thrown around. DeCoin's trying to do a grasp on that July 4th week. But Peoria, for example, the people in town here, they have no idea of like a lockdown weekend, say like last weekend in July or first weekend in August, where this year it's in August, where last year it was in July. So how do these fans that don't follow AFT, but they know the TT races here in Peoria, how are they able? They might not even know the American Flat Track name. They just know that there's motorcycle races once a year on a Sunday, where this year, you know, it's on a Saturday. So maybe that's a bigger issue, not so much for the core fans, but the core fans aren't what we're hurting right now. The core fans are our core fans. They're going to, you know, live and die by this brand, American Flat Track. We are struggling, I would say, in a way, just because we need to bring in the new fans, the younger people, the teenagers, the 20-year-olds, the 30-year-olds that are going to eventually have kids and then bring them to the races and bring their friends. Just like I showed my friend that dirt car race. No, now he's more willing, and probably there's a chance he starts watching it a little bit on his own.
Yeah, I think you're right about that consistency. You know, for people that aren't diehard fans or, you know, couldn't even necessarily call themselves fans, they just enjoy going to that particular race in their town. You know, when it's consistently coming back the same weekend every year, you know, they just know that there's a motorcycle race. And so I think you do miss out on some of that. And I think part of it too, you know, the couple of World of Outlaw races that I've gone to watch, you know, bought a ticket and gone into the grandstand, it's just the program is so good and smooth and consistent. And it's like there's always, you know, excitement or something going on. And I know cars are different, obviously. Track prep is way different for them. You know, cars, they've got four tires, four gigantic tires. You know, but I think that flat track could get a little bit better as far as that goes too. The show, you know, if they're going to these tracks that are so, you know, well known and established, that have good track prep crews that do it all the time, you know, for big shows, whereas we're going to some of these, you know, horse tracks or whatever, you know, middle of nowhere tracks that don't have that many races or big races or any races at all even. And so they're kind of caught with their pants down. Like, we don't know what we're doing here. Like, what should we do? You know, how do we make this track better? So I think like that part of that could help too, is if we're going to good places that have great track prep crews already on site, you know, to help our track prep crews that travel with AFT, I think that would make a big difference in the show and keeping the excitement going. Because, you know, when I've gone to a couple World Outlaw races, I feel like, you know, I pay the admission, I go in and sit down, and it's like nonstop until I leave, and it's only like 3 hours. Like, it's not an all day thing, you know, event. And it's awesome. And I walk out like, holy crap, like that, you know, why can't we be that way?
They do a great job of keeping,
No, go ahead. I feel like we went somewhere in the past year where that track wanted to do the track prep, and they made it like their mission that they were going to do the track prep, and it turned out really good. Do you remember where that was, Andrew?
I believe it was Chico. I think it was Chico. I think it was, you know, Brad Sweet's track, and I think that, you know, it almost seems like it's tough to get the AFT guys to let go of the reins a little bit. I mean, obviously they're dirt track guys and they're around us all the time, and you know they should know what's best for bikes. But at the same time, as being a former racetrack promoter, like, no one knows the dirt better than you. Like, it's your track. You know whether it's cars or tricycles going out, like, you know, you know your racetrack, you know your dirt. And so, you know, I don't like having the idea of having this outside group come in with their series, and then their track prep guys are going to tell you what to do. In my opinion, is ridiculous. Like, no, it's your track. You know it better than anyone. You're going to prep it to an extent, and then they can take a look at it and say, okay, you need a little more of this or a little less of this, and then work from there. And I would hope that that's what they do, but sometimes it really doesn't seem that
way. Yeah, no, like a really simple way to put it is, imagine an executive at one business goes over to a completely different sector, a completely different kind of business, and he can probably do a okay job learning it, but there's no one that's going to run it better than that company at that time. Like, our track prep guys are good, but when you have consistency doing the same dirt, and those track prep guys that you go to these tracks, they live, breathe, and die that dirt, and they love that dirt. So there's definitely a good point of at least letting them have a lot of say in how it goes, because Chico, by the main events, it turned out to be a killer racetrack.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that our guys aren't good, but every place is so different. Every dirt is so different. Every surface, every track. And you know, yeah, like Chico was incredible by the end. And then you look at, you know, another place where that same sort of thing happens is Lima. You know, Jared's got Steve Beattie and then the crew doing the prep and in charge of it, and they do an incredible job. And that's arguably one of the most difficult tracks to maintain in prep, because it's constant, and it's almost every single time, you know, we go out, every after every session, work needs done. And so, you know, he's able to keep it flowing and pretty consistent and pretty even for everybody, and keep the show moving. So it kind of answers the question there. Like, you know, yeah, you do need to let the people that are at the track, you know, part of the track, really help out as much as possible with the track prep.
For sure. And just having that willingness to compromise goes into building those relationships and wanting to have that series back. If you've got an abrasive interaction between the track prep crew that's there on a weekly basis and the crew that's coming in for this, you know, one-off event, if you have abrasive encounters there, then it's going to rub off the wrong way, and you might not have the promoters wanting to deal with it again or welcoming you back. So yeah, just having that sort of compromise and building those relationships is key. Another aspect I think that AFT needs to look into, and I don't know if they have already, but in 2023, I was able to go to 5 nationals, and Daytona and Senoy, I did the pit pass upgrade. But when you buy a pit pass upgrade, it was almost like a whole second ticket. So you're spending close to $100 to have pit access. And I think they're missing the ball there, because with the World of Outlaws event, you can buy a GA ticket or a reserve ticket, and then for $5 or $10 more, you get full pit pass access, and you can be right there in the paddock with all the drivers, all the crew. You can be up close to the action, and you still have a good shot of the track, you know, for when you go watch racing. And I think that AFT should maybe drop their their pit pass deal down a little bit. I know they have the fan walk, and that's when people can come meet the riders, but just being able to have that access to the riders and the crews and have that up close interaction throughout an entire night for a more affordable price point, I think is something they should look into as well to draw more people there.
I totally agree with you. And I think the issue is that the price point that they're at doesn't match the product that you get as a fan. I think, you know, that's kind of an issue there.
For sure. Yeah. There's so much downtime during an American Flat Track Day. And, you know, it's during the night show, you don't feel it as much, but practice and qualifying, I feel like, drag on forever in a day.
Yeah.
Andrew, I want to talk to you a little bit about this new rider you're going to be helping out with in 2025. You've worked with him before. So how excited are you to be partnering up with First Impressions for next year?
You know, I'm really excited. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be different. You know, it's going to take some learning the team, the bikes, the rider. But I'm really optimistic, and I'm excited for it. And Evan was Renshaw was the one that I really wanted to work for if it wasn't going to be Cody. You know, I have worked with him a touch in the past when he was an amateur, just kind of helping out where I can. Amateur nationals or whatever, and helping his dad out, and just any way I could, and I like his riding style. I like his personality. Obviously, he's good on the Austrian bikes. That's kind of what he grew up racing. So, and it's what I've been working with the last 4 years. So, you know, I'm confident that we can do well with it, and I think the team, you know, Eric and Ashley have. Really, their team has come such a long way from where they started. You know, Ashley joked that they had like 15 riders at one point 1 year. And like, you know, it was true. They were kind of all over the place and helping anybody and everybody, but they've really toned it down and refined their team, you know, in the last 2 years. And they have a really good product. I mean, last year, you know, James was always consistent and right there. And then, you know, after he had his injury and Chad stepped in, Chad was right there, and he was at the front even at Springfield, and they had a good, you know, power package. And so I think they've been kind of sneaky and a little bit under the radar, you know, as far as how far along they've come, you know, to where they are now. And I'm really excited to get to work with them. They seem like a lot of fun, you know, good people. The vibe is going to be a little bit different because I've felt like with the, you know, last 2 years, especially, you know, with KTM and with Cody, that like we'd won the championship the year before and won races, but it's like it almost feels like more pressure to win more and win the championship again, and like you want to win more, and this is definitely gonna turn down the anxiety a little bit. Like, you know, I'm going into something new rider. There's no guarantees. We could not win any races. We could win every single race. You know, who knows? So we're going to have fun and see what we can do.
You've done it too before, like jumping in with me and then working with Cody. It doesn't seem to take too long to be able to find success. And I think you bring the best out of like me and Cody. Just it's chill. And when it gets taken too seriously, then nothing kind of works as good as it should. We always kind of had fun. I remember a lot of the times me and you, we'd stay in the same hotel room and I'd end up getting a blue Gatorade and a Pop-Tart the night before the race. Then we'd watch a little Trailer Park Boys and just have fun. And then, yeah. You know, at times where I kind of got a little too serious and just my brain wasn't where it needed to be, that was some of the worst that I would do. So it'll be neat to see you hop in with Evan just because, one, like you said, his riding style is so cool. And just two, I think you're really good at bringing out the best in young riders. And Evan being back on the KTM, I know me and you talked about it a little bit off this. He's grew up on that and he feels really good on the steel frame. And then obviously you have this huge notebook of what you were able to use with Cody. So that will be super nice going into next season. And I saw today, I don't know if this is what you guys are using, but that truck and trailer that Eric shared on his story, I think was sick. The wrap he had and just the trailer itself and everything was sick. Do you know at this point, like, the extent, do you have to do any work during the week on bikes, or are you just kind of a fly-in guy?
So we're still like trying to, you know, I'm still working on figuring out everything exactly, but I'm for the most part going to be essentially a fly-in guy, you know, and Ashley's going to do all of the work, you know, during the week as far as maintenance. And I think they have a driver that helps drive, you know, the truck, or I don't even know. I honestly don't even know. Like, I didn't even see that story. I didn't see that. Yeah, I haven't met him either, but I didn't see the story, you know, that you're talking about. So I don't even know which truck and trailer you're talking about, but I know they've got a couple different things, and I don't know yet what it's going to look like. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting, and I'm definitely excited for it.
No, that'll be sweet. That guy, I can't remember his name right now. I think it starts with
Johnny, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Johnny. Last year after Chico, it was James's 21st birthday, and Johnny went out during the race day. He left the track. He went out to Walmart, I think it was, and bought an entire suit, like full dress suit, and made James put it on. And then it was like, it was some big week at Chico State there. And we went to a bar, and Johnny's in this leather jacket with these wing tassels coming off the bottom, and James is in this suit. So obviously with Eric too, the vibes will be high. That'll be fun. I'd talk to you about it too. I'm really hoping you guys get a win. That'll be an experience.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. You know, it's weird because I've had, and it's probably because I'm tall and as tall as a rider, but I've had a lot of success with tall riders, you know, yourself, Colby, and then Max, and then Cody, everybody, you know, 6 foot tall or taller. And so I guess I kind of relate to you, obviously, as being in the same boat. But just the kind of, you know, not everyone's exactly the same, but when you're tall, you kind of have to ride a certain way, and no matter what, because your knees getting in the way of the handlebars and things like that. I'm really excited to work with Evan. He's a good kid, you know, and I think that it's a lot. It's weird. Like, I'm getting like a deja vu kind of thing, because it's a lot like when I started working with Cody. You know, I was with Max the year before, and then, you know, Red Bull brought on another rider, and they called me up, and they're like, hey, you know, we're going to put you with this new kid. His name's Cody Kopp. I'm like, I know it's Joe Kopp's son, and I've seen him ride. I don't know a ton about him, but you know, it was a tall, lanky kid coming off of a Honda who previously rode KTMs and didn't really gel with the Honda a whole lot. Going back to the KTM and, you know, just excited, you know, hadn't got a win yet, and was just hungry for more. And that's literally what I've got going with Evan. You know, I got this kid that 17 years old, coming off of a Honda, hasn't won yet, but really wants to, and is young, and it's going to be exciting. You know, when I first worked with Cody at the Throwdown in 22, I left there telling people he's going to win races. And, you know, I worked with Evan just a little bit on my gas in South Carolina, and I'm already, you know, feeling that way, like this kid's going to win races next year. You know, we've got the Clash this weekend, and we're going to be, you know, with the team finally officially and on the bikes. And I'll have a better sense then, but I'm still pretty confident that he's going to be a problem next year, and that he's going to get a win.
Yeah, rookie seasons are tough. You don't know a lot. There's so much learning that goes into it. And yeah, the second year for him is going to be very good, especially just working with you, working with a team that's no pressure at all, being back on the steel frame, just having the experience of one full year under his belt. And then, too, and he mentioned on Corey's podcast that he didn't take his training as seriously as he needs to. So hopefully that is something that, as a young kid, you can kind of say that. And I've said it when I was younger, and did I probably train harder? Maybe a little bit, but hopefully Corey is able to, you know, instill in him that if you put in this work right now at 17 years old, the fruits are going to pay off. You're going to be able to make great money. You're going to be able to get wins. You're going to build your legacy, and you're going to be able to build a career that you're proud of and not look back when you're 30, 35 years old and say, dang, I wish I would have trained a little bit harder when I was 17 to get that win.
Oh, yeah. And I remember a few times hearing Corey complain about it this year to me when we talk, you know, about him. Oh, I don't know. He's not coming around and training. He's not, you know, doing, he's not taking it serious as I want him to or all the time. And, you know, I even talked to Evan about that at the end of the season, you know, after Corey complained to me a few times about it. And he's like, oh, maybe you can get through to him. And I said, Evan, dude, you know, I know Corey can be annoying or whatever, you know, dad number two, but dude, you know, love it or hate it, he knows what he's talking about, and he's like an incredible asset to you to get you right. And you know, he's only gonna help you, you know, get your body right, and focus on the job. And yeah, he's definitely, I know he's back training all the time with Corey. And he, you know, like he said, he didn't take it as serious, and he recognizes that. And hopefully he sticks with it. And I really hope he does. And I think he's going to be a problem if he does.
Yeah, you just don't know what you don't know at that age. And you hear people say it, and you might think you're putting in work, but you're probably not. It's to be able to do it, like, at the highest level, like, say, you know, JD's the first one that comes to my head. His work ethic is unreal. So it was cool for me to be able to always see how hard he worked. And I never got probably near the amount of work that he put in on the bike and off the bike. Like at this age, I wish I could go back, you know, 5-10 years ago and just take the knowledge that I have now and redo parts of my career. And I know I would have done a lot better at certain points.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that I feel, or I know that, you know, is a part of the training, what it helps is the discipline, because it applies to your on track as well. You know, if you're disciplined enough to be dedicated to this training program and the focus, you know, it's not only going to be in your physical health, but it's also going to be, you know, in your mental health and in your mental ability. I think it's all rolled into one.
Yeah, and there's something about, like, the mental side, too. Just, like, I, a lot of the times, would, in my head, right before the start of the race, I'm like, I'm in a hole shot. Like, there's no one going to beat me into that first corner. And just having confidence that you can do it, and then telling yourself and hyping yourself up that you're going to do it. Kind of the same thing with if you have good fitness. It's like, all right, come minute six of this race, it's, I'm coming, I'm chugging.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of will it into existence or think it into existence. For sure.
Well, we're definitely excited for that. I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys are able to accomplish in 2025. You know, no pressure, but you did win the first race with Cody, so coming into Daytona, yeah, no pressure there. Yeah. With that time that you guys got to sort of to spend together at Mid Carolina, what did you pick up during that time with Evan that sort of made you switch into feeling so confident in him winning races for next year, versus where it seemed like he was a little bit down at the end of the AFT season?
You can just see it on the bike. You can see it in their posture, you know, and in the body language and what they're doing with the motorcycle, you know, on corner entry, in the center, on the exit. You can really tell when they're vibing with it and when they're feeling it and when, you know, they have confidence and they want more. You can see it. And I feel like, you know, Evan, he did pick it up at the end of the year on the Hondas, but he just never had that look like he had that fire in him, that confidence on the bike that he could do whatever he wanted. And I feel like he's got that. He had it on the KTMs when he was an amateur, and even on my bike, which, you know, isn't all that great, he had that. He had that look to me. And he seemed that way even talking to him. So I just think that once we get on the race bikes and stuff that's set up for them and in better condition and all that, that it's going to be, you know, even more of a game changer. And I know he wants success. He does. He's not happy with the season he had. And I keep telling him, dude, you got to look back at other guys' rookie seasons. I mean, you know, Dallas, yeah, I think he got a win in his rookie season, but other than that, he didn't, you know, set the world on fire. And Cody was the same way. And Trent, and you start looking at all these guys, Sadoff, Drain, you know, they didn't all win everything their first year. They didn't win the championship their first year. So he's hard on himself about how he did this year. But when you really look at his results, they're pretty good, almost better than some of the other guys. So for a good rookie season, in my opinion, he's really set to do even better next year. And we're going to try really hard to do that.
And he was going up against, like me and Scotty have called it many times, the three-headed monster of Chase.
Absolutely.
And Tom, it's not like it was an easy year where there wasn't any dominant forces. I mean, I think those three guys won every race this season. So it's not like it would have been easy. And for him to get a win this year would have been almost a bigger feat than some other times, just because those three guys were so locked in. And you've got Cody Kopp, the three-time singles champion. But anyways, let's pivot a little bit to more of like a true fan side. What's one thing, and you're not a mechanic, you're just a fan, you're sitting in the grandstand, what's most exciting for you next year? Like, what are you looking forward to? What are you looking forward to this off season? Like, who do you want to know what they're riding for? Like, what's exciting you? Both of you. This goes to both of you guys.
Oh, man. Well, I'm excited to see what everyone's riding, you know, other than the Essensen team. What are people going to ride? Are they going to ride KTMs, Kawasaki's, Harleys, Suzuki's, Yamaha's? What's Breyer going to be on? Is he going to be on the same team? What's B-Rob going to ride? You know, so I'm pretty excited to see the motorcycles. It's going to be like I feel like these last few years when we go to the racetrack, there's a lot of Indians and they all look the same. They don't really change. The paint schemes don't change. The frames don't really change. But like for next year, it's going to be like a whole new scene. You know, there's going to be a lot of different new bikes and different looks. So I'm kind of excited to see that, really.
I like it. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what bikes. And I wonder, too, if as many people will be on that Howerton chassis like Breyer was on in Michelin. They look sick. I love the way the gas tank is. I love the gas tank cover, the bodywork. It looks really, really cool, but it never just all the time worked great. They always struggled with it. I know that Breyer he never looked super comfortable, super happy on it. So it'll be neat to see if people still stuck on that, or if they went towards like a J&M or C&J option, or were able to make something custom by themselves too.
Yeah, I'm just, as far as like AFT goes, I'm just excited for us to finally like get to Daytona. So we have all our questions answered on who's going to be on what, how many riders are we going to have? What's the twins class going to look like? You know, who's going to be making their debut in the singles class? Who's maybe moving back? You know, is there anybody going to go two ways? I've heard a couple of rumors about a rider who might be, you know, dabbling on like half the twin season but running a full single season. So just to have those questions answered. But as predictable as this probably was going to be, I think the thing I'm most excited for next year is Winter Throwdown, to be honest. Just that event is so much fun to go to, and Corey's done a great job with that, and it's cool to see him starting his series and to see the sort of expanded RPM schedule. Just there's a lot of flat track racing that's going to be available, be it AFT or outlaw quote-unquote racing. I'm just excited for riders to have the opportunity to compete and hopefully hone their skill set, and maybe we can continue to build up the rider counts at the professional level, starting with the amateurs,
and the money available too. The last 2 days, the National Flat Track Series has announced that here at Spoon River, which is just like 30 minutes from my house just outside of Peoria, they're saying that there's going to be $10,000 to win the twins class and $3,500 to win the singles class. So there's a good chance that one person brings home $13,500 that night, which I have no idea where that money's coming from. There's no sponsors on the sheet yet, but it's all over Facebook. So I hope it comes true, because that'd be amazing for someone to be able to make 13.5. I saw Jared was commenting on it, and Cody had commented on it a little bit, but that amount of money is crazy.
Spoon River, dude, you can bet that Jeff Carver is going to probably roll out of the woods and sweep both classes, isn't he?
Yeah, there's a chance, and it's open rules. I mean, the tire liners, the tire, what they're lacing the tires with on top, what they're doping it with, just the rules are open. I'm sure there's, I mean, if there's that much money available, Jared probably come with a full-out Indian, no restrictions. Yeah, I hope that it's able to become, you know, it happens where it's $10,000 to win a twins class race T.
What weekend is that?
So that's July 12th, 13th. So it's the weekend after DeCoin Mile. I don't know if there's a competing AFT race. I'm sure there's not.
No, there's nothing after DeCoin.
But like if there was, I wouldn't be mad, because I would even maybe break out my Cowie twin, which it's in shambles. It's not good. But I mean, if no one's showing up, 10 grand on the line, that's a lot of money towards the wedding fund.
Now that should fall right in line with, should be right before Corey's deal in Peoria and right after DuPoin and Amateur Nationals, so all right there in Illinois. So yeah, that's a big opportunity. I haven't heard about that. That's one of those scenarios where it's like, if I won the lottery, I wouldn't tell anybody, but there'd be signs.
Yeah, the track's sweet too. The last time we raced there, I remember Hayden Gillum went out for the first heat race. It was the first heat race of the night, and it's really high bank for people that haven't been there. Really, really banked. Hayden Gillum goes out in the first lap. He gets the whole shot. He's leading. He's within maybe a foot, 2 foot off the top of the track. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, oh man, now I got to go do that too. But that track's sweet. I remember that night I had a really good battle with Charlotte Canes, and there's a video on Flat Track Live that I like to frequent to watch that. And she ended up beating me. I think she got third place that night. And that's, you know, it's really special that, I've got that to look back on, and she was so good there, and just that's a great memory for me. But yeah, that racetrack's sweet, and then all the stuff coming out with Corey right now with his, you know, his program and the purse, and then even those necklaces, the jewelry that you get at the end of the year being the champion. It's cool. Outlaw flat track racing, it's a good time to be an amateur, that's for sure.
Definitely is.
Andrew, I gotta ask, is the reason Cody didn't win the Brisbane Cup because you weren't down there with him?
Oh, definitely. Come on now.
Did you get to follow along with any of the, or look at any of the results and follow along with any of the stuff that people were posting on social about that?
I mean, I tried to, but I couldn't really find anything as far as like official results until, you know, these guys posted how they did, but you know, some clips and pictures here and there.
Those pictures today coming out of those tires just bam.
Oh yeah.
It's so cool to see.
Yep.
What causes that?
It's just a soft tire, and it has a really tall sidewall, and so just, you know, at speed, the way it's twisting and flexing, it just has a funny look to it.
Do you think that would work on like a Medina TT cushion size track?
I don't know. It might. It would definitely be pretty cool to see someone try it.
Yeah, I was wondering if it'd work on, say, like a track like that or a half mile. I don't know if it'd be a half mile would be too fast for it to be able to hold up.
Yeah.
It's cool to have those guys get to go down there. You know, one of the things I talked about in a video that I posted earlier this week is just like getting to see that, like, Cody and Dallas had the opportunity to go down and compete in Australia, even though the Brisbane Cup is a totally different, it feels like a completely different sport, which is the way that those bikes are set up. Versus even what the Australian Flat Track, you know, series does that Tom and Dallas and Max were doing just before that. But it's cool to see them get the opportunity to go down there and sort of have Flat Track like get that like world representation in Australia during these winter months, the same way that like Sprint Car Racing gets it on their events and Supercross has it with their stuff. So it's cool to see a couple of our guys get to go over there and compete and dice it up. And to see Jack Miller down there competing with them is cool. I would love it if we could somehow get Jack Miller on a stateside flat track race. Or there was also a picture of Pedro Acosta doing some flat track training in the off season too.
Even like Dallas, you know, there's a lot of kids that would just love to ride with, say, Dallas. And then Dallas posted today about how cool it was to race with Jack Miller. And that's neat to see. And then I had that same kind of experience. I got to ride with Nikki Hayden a few times. And for me, it was just so, it's just kind of like a hero in our eyes. It'd be like a motocross kid getting to ride with, say, Eli Tomac or Ken Roczen. It's neat to see like your hero, they're riding with their hero in a way.
Andrew, you talk about like get earlier in the very beginning of the show, you talked about getting to, you know, work with Sam Lowe and all that. Do you have any stories of any battles that you had with Sam racing when you were coming up?
Oh man, you know, I'm sure there were a few. You know, he's a little bit older than I am, but you know, I do remember like I beat him on a half mile, a clay half mile in Indiana once when I was like 14 or so. And like I remember that being like the pinnacle for me. I was like, oh my god, I beat Sam Lowe, and it was so cool for me. And I think like Zach Palmer was racing too, and I was like, dude, these guys are pros. Like I beat them. So, but yeah, I mean, I raced with them at the local track, Lawrenceburg. You know, chased them, you know, throughout my amateur career there, first getting on 450s and stuff, and yeah. Yeah, definitely some battles.
We've seen, you know, Trent and Trevor Bruner be, you know, finding success in AFT in the singles class, and both of them coming out of Lawrenceburg. What about that track do you think helps hone rider skill sets when they are coming up through the amateur ranks and into the professional level? I mean, it's such a dicey little tiny short track.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a tough track because it's not like the surface isn't loose. So you don't have a ton of traction, and it's, you know, depending on the weather or the track prep, it's sometimes it's crazy hooked up, sometimes it's really slick and very hard to pass one line. So things like really good starts, you know, obviously you got to have that. And then if you do get the lead, get the whole shot, like you have to be perfect. You have to hit your lines, you know, every corner the whole time, because there's someone breathing down your neck ready to pass you. So it teaches you a few different things that, you know, roll over into professional racing really well with the, you know, obviously you got to get off to a good start, but then the whole time, you know, you're on the track, otherwise you got to be on it and you got to be hitting your marks and you know, constantly getting after it in control the whole time.
Did you guys ever get to run the big half mile that's right behind it?
I never did. I think some guys did, you know, back in the day, but especially since it's, you know, got redone a few years back with the crazy high banking and walls and everything. I don't think any bikes have been on it since.
That thing is scary, bank. It is wild.
It is wild, yeah.
And like too, on the point of Lawrenceburg from the outside perspective, I think too, it teaches you how to be really aggressive, because if they don't make a mistake in front of you and you want to win the race or keep moving forward, you're going to have to learn to bump them out of the way. And two, you have to do it in a way where you have to be safe too, to make sure you don't high side off the back of them, where you can move them good enough to get by them and then get away from them in time too. That's one thing that as a kid I never really had in New York. We really didn't do too much aggressive riding like that, like never bumping into each other. We didn't have necessarily a short track small enough where you would need to do that. The tracks were always pretty good condition, where the grooves are wide enough where you could make a move around the outside or get a run on someone on the inside and get by them in time to not have to bump and run. One time, Andrew, at Springfield Indoor, we were young,
oh boy.
And Levi Mayer took me up there, and Andrew, this tall, skinny kid, I didn't know who he was, didn't know anything about it, 34F, red numbers on the plate, smacked me coming into the corner, and that was like one of the first times I ever probably got run into. I'm sure I was pissed, because in New York, it's like, you don't run into anybody. That's not something that we do, and then I go to Springfield Indoor and just get smacked, and it was like a needle track. I mean, super, super small, tight corners, and I mean, not long straightaways, but the corners were just so tight, real paperclippy, and Andrew got in the side of me, and that was probably the first time I ever met Andrew. I don't think we talked. I probably cussed inside of my helmet a little bit.
Yeah, no, I had seen you, you know, at like the Ohio Cush and a Half Miles, you know, growing up. You were a kid, you know, on like the 80s and stuff and 250s. But yeah, like, I think that was like one of our first times actually racing together. And that was like the tiniest short track ever. And yeah, I can't remember. I can't totally remember what the circumstance was, but I just know, I think it was like practice or something. And you had gotten out in front of me and I was like, come on, kid, get out of the way. And so I just had to lay it on you there.
Do you remember that night when Luke Baird like got off the track or cut the corner or something and got the banners stuck in his bike and his wheel, and he just, instead of stopping, he just kept going. So he's just kept taking down just rows and rows of banners, and eventually there was a corner flagger who happened to be one of my good buddies, Rooks DeRozier, and he just laid him out. And then so he laid Rooks out because the banners caught his legs, and then finally he stopped. And we were just teasing him about it at Springfield a couple months ago. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. I do remember that. And I that was that there?
Yeah, well, it was because it was the only place that was that
Okay.
tight.
Okay, because I was torn between like, was that at DuCoin or was that there? But yeah, no, I do remember that. And that was that night too. Part of the reason I don't totally remember that, I don't know if you remember, Colby, but there was like JD Beach racing there, Rob Pearson, and maybe some other guys. I can't remember, but those guys got to banging on each other in the one heat or main, whatever it was. And they ended up running wide, and I passed them and took the lead. And like a lap or two later, JD Beach just stuck it to me coming off the corner, and I hit the wall and wrecked massively. I remember it was pretty brutal. He didn't mean to, but yeah, I think I was seeing stars after that one.
That track was tight. I don't remember that. I just remember Luke taking out Rooks and almost all the banners in the track, and then you running into me. Those are the memorable moments from that night for me.
You gotta have thick skin if you're gonna run indoors. I mean, like we talked about the Gateway Nationals with the late model guys, they're running over each other. I'm going up to Timonium in a couple weeks, and you just gotta expect to get run into at least 3 or 4 times if you're gonna go run stuff like that.
Would you do something like that, Andrew? Like Timonium, concrete indoor?
Would I ride it?
Yeah, like back, like, would you enjoy something like that?
Oh man, maybe when I was younger, yeah, but now no.
Yeah, I don't even think like a few years ago I would have enjoyed that. I just personally, I don't like that rough, like getting into having to move someone racing. Just, I think it's because I didn't grow up, you know, doing that stuff. I never had tracks that small, but I don't know. Timonium just doesn't. I love to watch it. It's great to watch. It's great content to watch, but for me, that's not super my cup of tea.
Yeah,
it's not a lot of people's cup of tea, but like you said, as a spectator, it's quite a time. And the times that we've gone up there, it's been impressive how many people they get to come to that. It's really cool to have, again, just that consistency and having that be an event there. And they're celebrating, I think, 50 years of racing up there this year, which is pretty wild.
And you'll have that. You'll be filming that because you're going up there.
Yeah, the second weekend, I'll go up there and film that night.
Yeah, that'll be fun to watch. All right, guys. I think that's a podcast. We've been on here for an hour and 40 minutes or something like that, an hour and a half. Andrew, I'm so glad you came on. This was a good time. I enjoyed reminiscing a little bit, enjoyed talking about the future and learning all about, you know, the different times working with Cody and the challenges he had with his mainly team changes. You guys, once you got a team, everything was rolling pretty dang good from there. But just getting, you know, the teams in place was tough. And then I'm excited for you guys to work with Andrew, or excuse me, with Evan next year, and you and Evan and the whole First Impressions team with Eric and Chad and Ashley. That's going to be good. I see a lot of success coming from there. And yeah, just excited to see that. And I booked my flight the other night down to the Winter Throwdown, so I will be there live to see the stuff.
Awesome. Yeah.
Andrew, thanks for your time. Best of luck this weekend. Enjoy Pensacola. Hopefully you guys get some good notes, get some good racing down there. I don't know if they're going to be streaming it this year, but I'll be following along with any live timing if they run through, if Robbie runs the stuff through Race Monitor again. So we'll try to keep an eye on those results. And if not, I'll just have Colby blow up your phone and get insight on that.
Yeah, awesome, man. I really appreciate you guys having me on. I love the podcast. I wish that there was, more of this, but I know like it's tough. Obviously you guys are finding that out firsthand, and then Corey said the same thing about his, that it's a lot of work, but it's pretty awesome to have you guys doing this kind of thing. I think that we need it and we need more of it. So really appreciate you guys doing it and having me a part of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thanks to all the listeners again. You guys keep us going, and I love to see the view counts going up each week, and just it motivates me to keep working and keep Scotty going. And me and Scotty's a lifesaver, man. He came up with a lot of the stuff to talk about tonight, and he does a lot behind the scenes. His memory, like I've said before, is amazing and just a true asset. I would not be doing this without Scotty Taylor on the other side. And I want to thank Andrew for coming on tonight. And as always, thank you guys for listening. This is lap 6 of the Sideways Podcast.